Hey.
Hey, Steven. How's it going?
Good. How are you?
Good. Good. Thanks for joining.
Yeah. Yeah, it works.
Yeah, this will be better than last time with the technical difficulties.
So I'm waiting to hear back from a friend, but I may need to miss the first 15 minutes or so.
Okay.
I do apologize, but I'll let you know, or I'll just mention that I need to go. So.
That's fine. Should we start broadcasting, Marco?
Yes, I believe we should.
You're still in practice.
Let me take a breath.
Okay, ready?
So what's going to happen is right now we're in sort of a green room. And when I start broadcasting, there may be some attendees who are able to log on. And I'll invite them on, whoever wants to come on the video with us. And those who want to remain, you know, just passively watching can stay there. So let's begin.
It looks like we've started.
It looks like we've begun, yes. Oh, there's Bridget. So I'm going to invite Bridget on.
Okay.
Okay, we are live, Bridget, with Transmuting the Trumpocalypse, episode 2. And we're recording right now, but we have not yet truly begun because I'm waiting to see if any other attendees show up, in which case I may want to invite them in, or I will invite them in, and they don't have to be live. So one thing that if for anybody watching, if you don't want to be on the live video, you can just watch and participate as an attendee. And to do that, you can use the chat function. There's a chat button on Zoom, which will let you communicate with us. And there's also a Q&A button. Which would allow you to pose questions that you know we and any of the panelists could respond to. So we'll give it another minute or two before we begin in earnest.
And I wanted to acknowledge that tonight Marco and I are switching roles. I'm kind of playing more of a tech support role, so I may mute you just to control the signal flow at different times. And there's this, you can just chat if you like, just type into the chat that you're ready to speak. And I'll try to keep an order going, especially if we have a larger group. If we stick with a kind of a smaller group, then I won't mute anybody and we can just keep the flow going more naturally. But if it gets to be a bigger group, I'll try to manage the flow a little bit through using chat to let me know that you want to respond and we can switch it up that way. But
okay.
There's also a special a special guest tonight insofar as he missed his flight, and so he's on his way to my house right now. A friend of mine, Alexei, who is one of the J20 defendants, which, if you don't know, has to do with a mass arrest that occurred during Trump's inauguration, and he was there as a photojournalist. So I hope that he will actually join for the call. Like, he could just walk on screen at any moment, basically. And he has some interesting perspectives as a photographer, as a photojournalist, about narrative work. Hopefully, we'll see him in a little while.
And we have a new person on the line. TJ, hi.
Got a muted audio.
Yeah,
how's that?
There you go. Mm-hmm.
Hello?
Hey, TJ. Hey, let's test your mic again. Remember last time you were kind of fainting? You might have the same issue this time as well.
Yeah, hold on. Keep going. I'll figure this out.
Okay, when you're close like that, I can hear you a bit better.
Okay.
So we were just about to begin the broadcast for our myriad viewers out there. And I'm going to begin with some remarks and open that into a kind of inquiry. It may or may not be a question grammatically, but it will be an inquiry. And then allow a conversation to unfold from there. And I have a sense of the arc of that the conversation might take, which kind of corresponds to an arc that is part of the essay series that Caroline wrote. And I'm going to try to describe that succinctly when we begin. But of course, what I expect might not occur. So we'll just see. And does anybody have any questions before we begin?
I'm good.
Okay, so let me just connect here.
Are they seeing me here? Are you sure?
Camera's this way.
Cool. Okay, so it looks like we're live. Right. And to get started, I'll reiterate, we're here on Transmuting the Trumpocalypse. This is the second in a series of three conversations that we're having to correspond and coincide with the publication of an essay series by Caroline Savory and a number of other pieces that we've published in the past year or so, and that we're in the process of publishing. This is an event that's being produced by and sponsored and put on by a journal called Metapsychosis, metapsychosis.com. It's a journal of consciousness, literature, and art. And we're also working on putting together a co-op, a creative co-op, to collaborate on conversations, creative work, artistic work, and developing ourselves as sentient and creative beings. And so this conversation, I'm going to pass it over to my co-host, Caroline, in just a moment to talk about some of the technical parts of it. But once we do that, I'm going to talk about kind of start an inquiry into the theme of meme power, or the mythology, the myths that we swim in our cultural existence. And I'll come back to that, but Caroline, would you like to introduce yourself and get us started on some of the technical stuff and mechanics for the call?
Sure. So welcome, everybody. If you watched the last video, then you know that I am the author of Transmuting the Trumpocalypse and co-founder of Cosmos.coop. So I'm playing kind of more of a technical role tonight, but I'll also be participating in the conversation. I just wanted to let everybody know that if you are in attendee mode, then you're only able to see what's happening and hear what's happening, but you cannot be heard nor seen. If you would like to participate in the actual dialogue, you can go ahead and chat. If you see in your upper left corner, you'll see a chat option. Go ahead and chat to me, or you can type it into the Q&A if you get confused about the chat. But let me know that you want to become a so-called panelist, and I will make you available to be seen and heard to the whole conversation. And for all of the panelists with us, thank you so much for being here. It's going to be a great conversation. And to let me know that you want to talk, if I don't catch the visual cues, I will be monitoring your video feeds to like look for signs that you're like, I'm ready to talk. Like John Davidson, thank you. Yes, waving, perfect. But if I miss that, go ahead and chat. Just make a little note like in the chat, and I will call on you next, and I'll unmute you at that point. So if you have any questions at this time, go ahead and put them in the chat, and I'll do my best to respond. Otherwise, I'm going to hand it off to Marco to start the questions. The generative questions that we can speak from.
Okay. All right. Before I do, I want to just welcome everyone. So Caroline, Stephen Polk, John Davis, Bridget Burke, and TJ. And there may be some other folks coming on in a little while. But part of what I want to say, just as a prelude to the conversation proper, is that the one of the goals that I have had in working on organizing these things is to have good conversations, to have conversations that perhaps we don't have as much. Certainly, you know, many people think that in our culture and in our society at this time. Part of what's happened is the changes in media, the changes in technology. There are social issues, political issues, etc. But one of the needs that I feel within myself and that I perceive more broadly is the need for better conversations. And part of what I think that means is that there's an exchange that happens between speaking and listening and being present to what arises in the space between people. And that's really what I would like to cultivate as a practice, and it's what I'd like to try to bring forth tonight. So how we're going to do this is, after I make a couple of remarks, I'll try to be succinct. We'll start an inquiry and give people the time and space to actually unfold their thoughts, to unfold what you're actually thinking, wherever it goes. And of course, to be mindful of where it's going and of others. But part of what we can practice, I think, is a being present when we're actually listening and speaking with one another, and letting that presence itself inform and affect the space. And so if anybody's watching this and doesn't want to do that, you can be in the attendee mode and in a more passive mode. But if we're present here today, what I would invite you to do is to really bring that presence, even through just your listening, even through that receptivity, which then, you know, flows into what you would contribute as part of the kind of music that we're making. At least that's how I like, you know, one way of thinking about it, one story that I might have about that. And so that's what we're here to talk about tonight is story, memes, myths, the narratives that inform who and how we are, and how that how an understanding of that can inform our perspectives on this Trumpocalypse thing that we're talking about. In Caroline's essay series, she makes a distinction between what she calls life power and meme power. And in these conversations, we kind of split it up. The first dialogue, we talked about life power. The second one, we're talking about meme power. And of course, they're always intertwined. But what I'd like to do in this talk is try to disentangle all those different threads and get some space and clarity around what we're talking about when we're talking about what we're talking about, like that meta, you know, entangled, confusing, crazy-making thing that is part of our like mediated, like hyper, you know, speed, accelerating landscape. So, Carolyn, would you like to add a little bit about that framing and kind of how you are, you know, distinguishing life power and meme power to kind of lead us into the conversation?
I don't have anything prepared to say, so I'll be brief. Just simply the idea that some of the ideas or stories or beliefs that we might adopt in the course of our living existences may or may not be appropriate for where the journey of our collective existence is taking us. And how do we develop the ability within ourselves to kind of be able to take some of these projections or assumptions or ideas we have at an arm's length and really discern whether they are something that supports life, our lives, and the lives of people and beings around us, or are actually unhelpful or unhealthy at a certain level that may not be apparent to the mind's eye, because at first glance, some of these myths, particularly the ones that I try to unpack in the pieces that relate to kind of the identity of the United States and us as Americans, can be seductive. They can seduce us into thinking that they can meet our needs, but can we really go into our consciousness as living beings and find a way to better better relate to those stories that we need for our culture and for our relationships, but find a way to make that more of a healthy arrangement. So today I'd love to explore ideas about, what makes a myth or an idea or a concept useful or not useful, and like what are, the ways that we get entangled by what we want to believe and things like that. So take it away, Marco. Marco prepared the questions for this, so I'm just going to hang back and maybe respond to them occasionally. Okay. But looking forward very much to hearing what you all have to say.
Okay. Thank you. So to continue right from your last point there, what I'd like to ask is, is what are the myths, the stories that are underlying our social and cultural reality and that we're not actually talking about, or that we're not actually aware of, or that you may be aware of that others aren't? How can we start to disentangle more of what we're not grappling with in our discourse at large? Like, what are the myths, good and bad, that we're actually, let's put it on the table. Like, what do you think is significant? What do you think is worth shining a light on? What are you confused even, or have questions about that perhaps others could help with? I'd like to just go there first and see what we're even really talking about when we're talking about memes or myths or the seductive allure of certain stories like the United States of America or white supremacy or the free trade, whatever it may be. Let's put it on the table and take it away. So I see Bridget raising her hand.
It's interesting because this is a question. I read Carolyn's piece, by the way, before I actually came onto this talk. It's excellent. It's very thought-provoking, Carolyn, by the way, and I love the question that you have at the end, especially. I used to actually give this when I taught religion class. I used to actually ask a very similar question about what are the myths of the United States? What are the kind of beliefs that you take for granted that you don't really realize that you take for granted? And I think the one that she brought up about white supremacy is a very important one. But we also have a tremendous economic mythology of capitalism. And I think that the capitalistic myth starts with Alexander Hamilton, but we also have this idea, this almost rags to riches idea that comes out of the 19th century, the idea that the person who works hard is the person who will be rich, which we all know is pretty much not true. However, that is a mythology, and it is the kind of mythology that not only keeps people, not only gives ammunition to say, well, people who are poor because they don't work hard. That sort of lazy, attitude towards citizens, but it also, for people who are not as economically well vested, I guess you could say, this idea that somehow that they have, no matter how the odds are stacked against them, that they one day that they will have a chance to be rich because that's how it works. So I don't know. I find that to be a real core myth that actually informs this American dream quite heavily, both positively and negatively. Okay. I don't know that I would make a value judgment on it necessarily, but it's certainly been used both ways. So that's at least one that I can think of off the top of my head.
Stephen, go ahead.
Yeah. And to build off of what Bridget was saying, and also a conversation that Caroline and I had a few weeks ago, is there a myth, or can we identify, myths, memes, narratives about who we are, then that are not formed and also serve the interests of concentrated power, whether that be the interests of private power or the capitalists, economically speaking, or the interests of the nation state or the interests of organized religion? What stories do we have that actually come or have their origins in who we are as like a people, almost like, I guess, at like the grassroots level or the working class level? And I haven't put my mind to that question too much, but I think it's an incredibly important question because especially in our society, I think a lot of the myths that we have, the rags to riches, the American dream, they don't threaten power by any means, but only serve, I think, to strengthen it. The American dream, for example, is the white picket fence, the nuclear family isolated from everyone else. I mean, that really does increase profit margins if everyone has to have their own washing machine, two cars, their own house, their own, you know, mortgage, a whole lot of debt, increasingly today, a whole lot of debt. But what about a story about ourselves that actually doesn't increase profit? So I guess I'll, or doesn't further the interests of the nation state or organized religion. So I'll leave it there.
I see John.
Can I chime in?
Sure.
I'm just remembering a play by Shakespeare, Coriolanus, and there's a riot. All the plebes are in the street and they're rioting because there's no bread and they're starving. And a senator comes out and he uses a metaphor of the body politic. And he talks about, and the, you know, the plebes are complaining because they do all the work and they're not fed, whereas the people who aren't working are getting all the food. And he basically talks about the belly. He compares himself as part of the governing class as the belly of the body. And the belly has the job of acquiring all of that food and distributing it to the arms and the legs and the, you know, the rest of the body. And I think that's a very ancient metaphor. And I believe it still operates in our politics today. And another metaphor that, and forgive me, this may be repetition. Maybe you've already written about this, Caroline. I haven't read all of your articles. I've read your first one, and I also listened to your conversation with Marco, your interview with Marco a while back. But the whole in cognitive linguistics, George Lakoff pointed out the difference between the Republicans and the Democrats were there was a metaphor, he thought, coming out of the family metaphor, that the Democrats were the mother and the Republicans were the strict father. And I think since he first formulated this, he's sort of changed his mind, because I believe now he believes that the Democrats and the Republicans are both strict father organizations. And I just find that useful, but I'm not attached to any of these. I know we probably all have all kinds of metaphors and stories that are circulating, but I think today there's a big scandal. Donna Brazile, who was the head of the DNC, has written a book exposing the Clinton, Hillary Clinton, as rigging the election. You know, this is something that Bernie Sanders supporters were saying all along. And this comes after a very dramatic election period. And I believe that Trump arose out of this kind of nefarious double dealing, double messages, which I think split the Democratic Party and allowed for his triumph into Rome. So I'm just sharing this with you guys because I think we're in the middle of another kind of narrative that I think starts to emerge as the shadow figures, which many, many of us intuited were operating behind the scenes. It's now starting to be revealed that some of the people who were engaged in that nefarious activity, that hidden activity, are now coming clean. And I think Donna Brazile has a motive, probably an ulterior motive, because she's publishing a book about this and she wants it to be a bestseller. But she's presenting hard evidence that this is the case, that it was rigged. Anyway, I'm finding that totally fascinating, because when I went to cast a vote in the primary, the place I had gone to for 35 years told me that I had been purged from the polls. They had no explanation why. And I immediately felt this gut feeling that we're living in a, this is the kind of thing you expect in a third world country. You don't expect it to be in the premier democratic country. And I felt, oh, they're screwing me. But then I found out that there were 200,000 other New Yorkers who had also been purged from the polls, the majority of whom were Bernie Sanders supporters. And then I did, as many of us did, filed a report with the New York State, the Attorney General. There was no answer given. We got no response. But then I was invited to rejoin the Democratic Party in time for Hillary's election. So I'm just bringing this up because I think this has a huge influence on how this, how Trump triumphed. And I think there's going to be another sequel to this. Maybe we can reorganize ourselves in a more compelling way than we have. I have my doubts, but I'm definitely I have my biases, and I am definitely on the left end of the political spectrum. So I've sort of washed my hands of these Democratic Republican love fest, really, because they're pretty much the same thing, variations on the same theme. Anyway, that's my two cents. God bless us all.
Anyone else want to chime in? I'll add then one thing, which is that this meme or this story of apocalypse has two sides to it. This is remarked upon by a number of people. James Curcio, in this book I've got, Narrative Machines, writes about this as the two apocalypses. One apocalypse is the apocalypse of, you know, of destruction. And this is in movies, TV, Walking Dead, etc. I mean, apocalypse is everywhere in that sense, in this sense, this feeling that we perhaps are even on the precipice of nuclear war, that, you know, that some, you know, someone could break that rule of that prohibition on mutually assured destruction. That even could happen. That possibility is kind of in the air. That's a meme or mythos. But the other meaning of apocalypse, right, is the revealing or the unveiling. And part of what I think, John, you're referring to with this view into the machinations of the Democratic Party and how it was rigged from the beginning. And, you know, I don't think we want to talk about the politics of it in this talk necessarily, but what seems to be the case, you know, what if we look at the evidence and what perhaps reputable people have to say, of course, reputable then is a question because almost everybody seems to be disreputable in some way. We're all compromised in some way by our participation in all of these games, right? But we're seeing it all, and it's maddening. It's hugely destabilizing to have that view into how things work and to have the kind of critical perspective. It's destabilizing. People actually don't like it. You know, like we get worked up about it, but that, you know, state of being worked up becomes a sort of, you know, an entanglement and a trance, like Caroline writes about in her essays. And then that fuels, you know, these further complications, or as David Foster Wallace said, permutations of complications in the ways that these stories clash. So I think that it's a really interesting moment for that. You know, I'm beset, you know, by it. I'm troubled by it, actually. I mean, part of why I have to meditate, you know, every day is because reality is such a freak show. And, you know, one has to do things to, you know, to keep a certain balance within the kind of whirlwind of things. But anyhow, I think I'm sensing that, Caroline, you want to say something.
Yes. that was intuitive of you to notice that. I was like getting excited because I was thinking about responding. In the essays, I really focus on trying to get to the bottom of some of our assumptions and stories about how the world is. And so I have to go through a few layers. It's almost like a, you know, geological strata. I have to talk about the U.S. and Trump and kind of the reverence we have for these institutions. I have to talk about, you know, white supremacy and capitalism. But then beneath all of it, I think, is it's so core as to be, I think, often invisible. It's the assumption that the only way of power is power over, which is understandable if you look at how we got here in terms of how many billions of people there are on the earth and how we've decimated ecosystems to get here and built cities and built, you know, and built global economies. In terms of the people who have prospered through these techniques, have learned to survive through enacting power over their landscape and power over the earth in terms of developing agriculture, and particularly European systems of agriculture developed in such a way that we're heavily reliant on irrigation and basically it required a lot of continuous development of land. I think I have a guest joining me.
I don't want to interrupt.
Yeah, but let me finish that thought. There is kind of a dichotomy that I suggest between colonized or colonizing, you know, cultures and indigenous or decolonized cultures. And specifically, it has to do with relating to the world in terms of objects to be manipulated versus subjects to be in relationship to. And I think we are born into a culture, and after many, many generations of this, really are accustomed to looking at the world as this kind of objective thing that we can manipulate, that we can interact with and manipulate, and that affects us. But really, it's kind of almost like a play. And we're not aware at that level that it's, also able to be related to and to be communed with. As living in terms of the living beings or the life power there. In my own ideas, in terms of concentrating life power, I see through a hope of combining our powers in more fruitful ways. And it's going to come through relationship. It's going to come through connecting to one another as subjects and not objects. With that, I'd like to invite Alexei.
Hey, y'all.
Hey.
Thanks for having me. Sorry, I'm a little late.
Well, are you going to participate? Would you like to join the conversation?
Hell yeah.
Okay. Well, we're talking about, basically mythos. We're talking about the stories that we're entangled in, that
sure.
From the multiple layers, as Caroline was saying, that perpetuate this situation that we're in, which, you know, we're playfully, I think, calling Trumpocalypse, but that Trumpocalypse having dual meanings as a destructive force, but also a revelatory phenomena where we get to see how the machine works and we get to see each other's stories and we get to perhaps experience where we ourselves as individuals or as communities or as groups or as organizations or as companies or whatever context we're in, are kind of caught up in stories that may not be to our benefit, our ultimate benefit. And so Caroline, I guess you heard what she was saying about power over and as one kind of meta narrative or one underlying narrative, but you could take it wherever you like.
Well, there's not much material to work with there. holy moly. I got the prompt that it was a kind of meme, narrative, subjectivity. I think about these things quite a lot. I have a blog called Narrative Warfare, which specifically talks about the dueling narratives and try to tell the stories of both of them at the same time. or as many of them as is needed. And I guess I'll just ramble. I don't even know. And each side kind of requires a belief that they're right, or correct. And that's part of how the narrative, I think, perpetuates. Period, new paragraph. I try to think of, we're talking about stories, and people can get so caught up in their stories, and they can be they can have emotional reactions to stories. And so I often play with the idea of what would, and if stories are related to identity, like stories of yourself in the world, what would a not having an identity look like? Like, could you get away from your own stories of yourself or your understanding of yourself? I'll leave it there for now. Thanks, y'all.
Yeah, go, Bridget.
Okay, actually, I have three thoughts. I think first, with respect to the comments that John was making, and Marco, what you were saying, is I'm inclined to think of a lot of discussion about the Trump presidency as kind of a revelation of the shadow in the Jungian sense, the idea that now we're seeing everything about ourselves that we don't really like to admit, okay? That's one aspect, but what Carolyn was talking about in terms of power over and that sort of thing, and the way that we see each other as objects rather than as subjects, again, I find myself thinking about the sort of mechanistic mythology that it's not only in the United States, but in Europe and in other places too, since the 19th century, at least, maybe earlier, this idea of the machine, and of course science as being the way to truth, which again, this is a potential negative aspect. And it's funny because I've actually written a couple of pieces on the other globalization, I think is one I wrote for Metapsychosis, on feminism and the idea that this lack of the, what I call the feminine, which is kind of the same thing that you're saying, that there's kind of an overly, I think I call it a logos heavy kind of a way of looking at things, where it's so heavy on rationalization and on logic and on method that we kind of forget what it means to be human and all those other things that go along with it. We sort of treat them as, you know, side effects or hallucinations or delusions or things we shouldn't pay any attention to. And the third thing I was going to say, now I've lost track of it, but anyway, so you've got those two things just to throw out there for what it's worth.
John?
Oh, sorry. TJ had chatted.
Oh.
Yeah. So I just unmuted TJ. Oh. So let's do TJ first and then John.
Yeah. My microphone is sometimes a little problematic. I was just going to throw out Chetan Bhatt's TED Talk. It's called Dare to Refuse the Origin Myths That Claim Who You Are, just to kind of piggyback on something Alexei had said. Really good talk. It's one of those, 15-minute things where he goes into just, this is what I've always known, this is what I've always been taught by society, but then can we step out of that and make connections among people? Just that you brought that to my mind. I was going to go back to memes for a minute. What does that bring up in everybody's mind? Just that title.
Reed Sicaria.
Yeah, this is the first edition. I'm almost done.
Perhaps the decline of American hegemony.
Right. Now he's not saying that America's going anywhere, but even just the thought, just this phrase, the post-American world, and you're like, well, that can't happen. We're number one. We've got freedom, we've got democracy, we've got the market, it was really interesting read that one. How does that challenge the meme though, I just lost everybody.
No, you're totally there. I had a welling thought, but I want to make sure I see that John also might want to say something.
Yeah, no, go ahead.
But I have trouble with the meme metaphor, because as I recall, it came out of Daniel Dennett, talked about the selfish meme. And I think it came out of his, DNA as the sort of top-down model in biology. And I think he tried to transfer that into the cultural realm. So I have a trouble with meme. I know you guys are using it in a more nuanced way than he was, but I think we need to recognize this has a history. And I think a very distorting history, because there's a big difference between biology, biological evolution, and cultural evolution, if you want to use evolution as an organizing principle here. And I just want to throw that out there. But also, I just wanted to note that, Caroline, I think you're using the language of the mother's tongue. I think you're talking about relationships and how valuable and important relationships are in primary. And I think that comes out of the mother. And I think the father is much more about tasks and justice and, you know, and I think both of them can be extreme. I think we can easily fall into codependent patterns by our zeal to commune with others. And also we can become very overly detached and destructive, as we all know, with those powerful, the downside of the patriarchy that I think we're seeing starting to collapse. But I don't think we're going to, I'm all for growing up and not needing mommy and daddy anymore. I do not vote for someone who's going to be a father figure. I didn't like my father. We didn't get along very well. And I didn't get along well with my mother either. So I'm ready to like toss that one out. I don't think it's a good metaphor. The family metaphor, I think, is a pretty lousy one. And I do agree that we are subjects, and we are subjects and we are objects. And I think that it's indeterminate sometimes. So anyway, I'm just throwing that out there, that there are all kinds of subtle possibilities that could be very beneficial that are not getting expressed in our current politics. And I really doubt that telling a story about stories, or telling stories about not needing an identity. I'm wondering who needs to have that story, because to me there's a sense of agency and acknowledging one's beliefs and one's biases, and there's a sense of agency. Actions can occur out of that sense of agency that are rational ones, not rather than driven by the irrational. And at the same time, and not to get too long-winded about this, I'm sort of losing my train of thought. So, but I think there's a sense of agency needs to be differentiated from society. And then we also have to recognize that culture is another player. I think we need to differentiate these strands, if you want to call them, and then we can integrate them. But I mean, as a gay man coming out when I did in the 70s, legally, a member of a legally discriminated group, the only legally discriminated group, I had to fight for a job, for a place to stay. My relationship suffered horribly from discrimination. I was spit on in the street. And I guarantee you, if I did not have a strong sense of who I am, a member of this group, we would have been annihilated. And then, of course, we had to deal with AIDS. So that mobilized us, and we reorganized our behaviors. And I believe we had some measure of success in shifting the consciousness of this, of our country. So I'm a great believer in differentiating and then trying to find a synthesis, an overlap between culture, society, which is our institutions and our laws, and our personal sense of agency. It was very important for us to change the law. If you don't change the law, if you don't strike down the sodomy laws, if you don't get those laws changed, nothing else matters. Because they can always, even if they're not used, they can be used against you. And that threat inhibits and I think constrains a person and prevents them from giving their gifts to the larger community. So it's then once you change those laws and those who are opposed to you are penalized because you can sue their ass, they change their hearts and minds. I've noticed this over and over and over again. They suddenly are able to like, oh, okay, if this is going to cost me, I think I'm going to change my the way I operate. Now, they still may harbor all kinds of homophobic, you know, but they don't act it out. They don't use the law to discriminate against a group they don't like. It no longer unifies them anymore. And I think this is being acted out again. It's I think there's a huge backlash going on because I think a lot of people who mobilize their energies around who's in and who's out of their group are in conflict with each other when they can no longer have that convenient scapegoat to punish. Thank you.
I didn't see any hands. Oh, Marco.
Well, I wanted just to weave in a few things that people have said, just to make sure that we recirculate the ideas or the memes, because I think that they are all interconnected, and part of what we're doing is disentangling them. So TJ showed us the book, The Post-American World. I read that book and years ago, and the idea of moving from a America-centric to a multi-centric geopolitical so that has something to do with what's going on. There's a historical process going on. TJ, you're a student of history, so perhaps you could, you know, bring that in, kind of deepen that point of what's really going on there, because that is tangled up then with these shadow aspects that Bridget you brought into the conversation. You also mentioned the feminine, and that being part of what is in the shadows, as far as how we constitute ourselves mentally and even politically, and then John, you shared your personal experience of being kind of on the wrong side of the mythos, from the perspective of, you know, the law and the ability to justify the enforcement of actions driven by beliefs. And so the importance then of going, of translating, let's say, from understanding or from idea into structure, right, into something enforceable. And then prior to that, Alexei was made the point, which I think was challenged and complimented by John's, that having a sense of no identity, or having a sense of not being attached to a particular identity or particular idea construct, could be important, could be liberating, because some idea constructs are, you know, are demonstrably poisonous and malignant. So I think that, you know, we're kind of all over the place, but we're all at the same time looking at a interconnected kind of hyper object of a phenomena and trying to kind of relate to it in some way, trying to kind of bring it into focus. So Caroline, please pick it up.
Thank you. I am not sure how much Alexei is able to talk about the case that he's facing. And so I'm going to say some words. So I can say what I think, and, you know,
yeah, sure,
you can piggyback off of that. But the bringing in, as John did, about how laws have such a profound effect on people's bodies and their treatment, and, you know, in the eyes of institutions that exercise very real power over, i.e. the state, Alexei is caught in kind of an event right now, which has to do, a lot of people are speculating that the way that the case of the J20 defendants is being prosecuted has to do a lot with who happens to be in office right now. Mm. And his, and Trump's, you know, kind of emphasis on loyalty and the kinds of people that he is installing in real positions of power in the government, including the Attorney General, are actually affecting this in a way that hasn't been seen before. Particularly around these issues of the illegality of the way the arrest was conducted, the you know, the freedom of speech, the inhibition of freedom of speech. And many people see this as actually a effort to intimidate and to target so that freedom of speech is inhibited even outside of the actual event that took place around the J20. Would you want to respond to that?
For sure. So a little background is I got arrested at the inauguration in D.C. performing as a photojournalist. And I live streamed it from beginning to end, et cetera, et cetera. And that's a significant detail for court. But I was facing 8 felonies, and now I'm facing 6 felonies and 2 misdemeanors, including conspiracy, riot act, incitement, and property destruction. So, I don't know if y'all knew that. So y'all have, that's kind of significant. So piggybacking on many things that John said, thank you so much. But one specific thing is, you know, I agree with you about the legalities, and the legalities are, force people to change their social habits and their beliefs, and it's a pushback, and so I could argue for it in a you know, like, that's a positive thing for the mass of society. But in another way is like, who are these people that keep on oppressing people? Like, why the fuck are we always up against that? And politicians and all this stuff, like, what is the actual systemic issues that are happening that we have to play all these games and this compromising and this politics and the voting and all this stuff? It's like, what is up with, you know, and Caroline and actually we're just talking about, you know, the path of open-heartedness. If whatever increases my chances to connect with people and humans and the planet and nature, I want to choose that path. But I see so many people choosing the path of othering and alienating and blaming, and, you know, and it's just like, that's where that whole culture battle, civilization battle, all that's up in that. So that, I guess that's a comment to something that happened all along the road. Thank y'all.
Thank you. Yeah, and just a final comment is that, you know, what are these institutions in terms of, like, they kind of embody certain values and certain rules and guidelines as far as what's normative. And as institutions who enforce what is current in the moment is normative and so-called normative in society. And we have to remember who actually retains their power in terms of government over time. You know, how can we actually influence that? And sometimes, you know, going through the channels of government is one tactic, but there's a lot of tactics that could help with warping or shifting, you know, what we find socially acceptable and therefore what we see reflected in institutions theoretically. That's all. Thank you.
Go ahead, Bridget.
Matt, one of the things, I know Robert Anton Wilson said it, and I may be paraphrasing him, but he more or less says something to the effect of, there are 2 kinds of people in the world, and the ones who embrace new information and those who reject it, okay? And what Lexi was just talking about there, I think this idea of othering seems to have to do, at least from what I can see, is the resistance to change and the resistance to things that are unknown or things that are new. If you, you know, you, when you are very much attached to an identity or a way of being or a way of living, then when you encounter something that is different from that or from what your expectation is, then there's there's 2 reactions to that. You could either become curious, you could become interested, and you could, you know, want to learn more, or you could take the attitude of that other is somehow a threat and you can push it away. And this has sort of been human behavior from time immemorial. And it's interesting, yeah, because it's just kind of like, okay, how do you get at that? If you have somebody who is sort of perpetually afraid of what's different, whether they're aware that they are or not, certainly authoritarian personalities have often come into the mix, especially now. You see a lot of articles about how the authoritarian personalities are the ones who elected Trump and so forth. But that authoritarianism comes out of a need for control. I mean, it's a need back to the idea of power again. It's the idea, and yeah, it's the matter of controlling, you know, what is it exactly that you're trying to control? But a lot of it just comes down to one's own ability or inability, I think, to negotiate very large scale change. And the more that the world changes, the more that things open up from what people sort of expect or think it should be, back to the stories, origin myths. When that is threatened, how deeply ingrained is that in the identity you've created for yourself? So it's, I don't know that there's an answer, but that's the perpetual question.
Can I respond to that?
Sure.
If someone else, unless someone wants to check.
Stephen, were you, just to check, because I saw you on mute. Are you cool?
Yeah, can you?
Okay. And TJ? All right, so just want to make sure that everyone has a chance.
I'm really interested in this topic of identity, because for me, I don't have one identity. I have multiple identities. I believe I have multiple personality, but I don't think it's a syndrome. I have an efficient multiple personality for the most of the time. Sometimes I have my off days. But I think the being able to reflect on the self and these different impulses and to be able to create priorities and what's important and what's not important right now in this particular context, we need a model of the self that really works. And I just want to offer the idea that we can find complements. We may have experiences or emotions or feelings that we don't like, but if we can hold them and find a complement, I might be angry and I'm also courageous. I might be scared, but I'm also curious. You know, these are complements. And I think that being able to reflect on the self is very crucial. And I don't think everybody can. I do think there's some people who do not want to, or they just go by their fears or their gut responses. And I think we're living in an age of complexity where there's people who are what I would call meta-reflexive, and there are people who are fragmenting under the pressures. And I believe that a younger generation is coming forward, and I believe is having to address these kinds of imbalances that have accumulated over many generations. So I take a deep, humble bow and really wish all of us the best. I hope that we can have an intergenerational sort of rebalancing, because I think I'm becoming quickly an elder, I think. I'm almost retirement age, and I'm having to deal with that and the poverty that I probably am going to have to face, because everything I had got wiped out in the last recession. So I'm having a look at that. It's not a pretty picture, but I still believe in having a compelling future anyway, you know, that I want to move towards. I think those compelling futures using our imagination are very important. And I just want to pass that on. I suspect that many of you, the younger folks here, are extremely imaginative people and are, you know, motivated to create that, a compelling future for yourselves. But I think that there are a lot of people who are breaking down under the pressure. And they're going to, you know, hunker down and use every defense that they can to maintain a status quo that is rapidly vanishing. That's all. Thank you.
Yeah, and I want to pick up on your experience and also your thoughts on identity, John, but you were talking before about how identity was a critical factor in the gay rights movement throughout the 70s and the 80s, and also your talk of identity here. And I was actually involved with a or a community education coordinator for an organization called Colorado Jobs with Justice. And we are doing popular education workshops with labor unions. And we were focused on this concept of worker identity or labor identity. So what does it mean to identify as a worker? And the reasoning or the justification, the rationale behind this was that when people have a strong sense of shared identity, their ability to work together as a collective whole to affect change increases considerably. And this is actually demonstrated by a recent article by Min Sun Robinson, I believe. This is the wife of the of Tony Robinson, who's the chair of the political science department, but she did a comparative analysis of workers in the efficacy of workers in South Korea versus the efficacy of workers here in Denver, actually. And it was about, you know, whether or not cooperatives are an actual change-making entity. And she stated that in South Korea, they are, because in South Korea, the workers have a strong sense of shared struggle together, a shared identity, and that it is this sense of shared identity and struggle that has propelled the movements forward. Whereas in the United States, worker identity and almost any sort of collective or communal identity has been thoroughly eroded. And I think along with that, our ability to affect change, not just in regards to like labor or building up any sort of union movement, but I think in almost any other regard. I think we have very little power to construct these identities that are counter-hegemonic. I think that kind of goes back to what I was saying before. I'm having a hard time identifying memes or narratives that are counter to the narratives that reinforce hegemonic power. And I think that that's something that we are not only lacking, but if we're to counteract the pop culture fetishization of apocalypse, which is everywhere, going back to what you were saying before, Marco, I mean, we can imagine the end of the world, and we do in pop culture 1,000 times over. But there are very few articulations of how we could live peacefully into the future. I said that in a classroom once, and a student immediately said, Star Trek. So maybe it is we develop a narrative of how we can together, transverse space once we figure out our shit down here. But yeah, I'll leave it at that.
I wanted to invite TJ to speak. We haven't heard as much from you, TJ. Do you have any reflections at this time?
A few. To go back to a boring history lesson from Zakaria's book, actually, he outlines how Britain declined through the World Wars, but also the middle of the 20th century. But how they kind of politically handled their decline a little better, because Britain's been around for 1,000 years. They've been a small nation. They've been a big nation. They've been a big empire. And then you kind of come back to a small nation. Whereas Stephen just brought up too, the rugged individualism of America and everything. I don't know that we could handle our decline, because we're just not even used to thinking of ourselves as something other than someone who has to be a player instead of the player, the big person in the room. And I was also, it's interesting, also another point, Stephen, you brought up about the communal and the ability of workers to kind of have that collective identity to even be a bargaining chip. Our rugged individualism plays right into the hands of the patricians, like John's opening remark about, you know, the plebes complaining because they're not getting anything. But here we're so segmented and divided, but that's part of our meme. That's part of our, we do it ourselves and we're big and, you know, we handle everything. There's no problem that we can't solve, but then we don't realize that there's no problem we can't solve together, but we don't quite get there.
That reminds me of something that was said last week by, I think, Eutemia. And it was, one way of reading it is just as a kind of story, and that's that it's very hard to ask for help, right? Like part of what we need, I think, is we need each other's help to survive the Trumpocalypse. If you, you know, and maybe not. I mean, maybe we can kind of squeak by on our own. We can be rugged individualists. I can, but I know that, I mean, you know, we all have to do that in our own way to differentiate, you know, as you were saying earlier. But I mean, part of what seems to be happening as well is that, you know, when you differentiate, when you kind of go beyond the, you know, the grand ego, the fantasy of the all conquering, the dominant ego, which obviously Trump exemplifies perfectly. I mean, he's sort of, you know, cast for the part, if you will. Then what you find is that there are many, 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 many other egos, and there are many, many other selves or aspects of self that are different than your own, and that are maybe just as right, maybe more right than you are. And this kind of decentering, you know, of the self, and is part of the move, or the, you know, perhaps one of the memes or the stories that might be more difficult, you know, for sure, but necessary to cultivate a culture of individuals who are able to be fully differentiated individuals at the same time that they're able to be in connection, communion, in interdependency with others. I find this to be one of the most difficult things, really. The idea of cooperating, for example, of there are ideals, and we have a certain, even America includes an ideal from the, going back to the notion of a suburban, healthy, prosperous middle class of a good culture, of a good citizenry, of neighborliness. But in practice, it's become so hard. And part of it is that we don't even believe it anymore in some way. And by we, I include myself, that it's so easy to fall into a kind of despair about even the possibility of it. But then you get good examples, then you see examples, like and you learn about how it kind of works and how it's important to be able to differentiate, disidentify at the same time as one identifies and commits and concretizes. And there's a flux and a flow between those. One of the metaphors that we've played with in the forum, TJ and John in particular, is that of the donut or the torus, because it represents a flow of inside and out, or the Klein bottle, the Möbius strip, these post-Euclidean geometries, which actually describe accurately the nature of consciousness in some fundamental way. And we're going through a certain kind of wrenching and torsioning process of learning how to navigate that, it seems to me. So I'd like to transition, if I may, to this last 20 minutes of the call. And I should have said it up front, but that we'd go for 90 minutes. And that's, you know, Stephen, you brought this up, that there are beneficial narrative stories, memes, for example, or identities. Identifying as a worker allows you to commune or to act collectively with other workers, for example. What are, if we don't have a grand unifying myth or narrative quite, and if we've kind of seen the limitations of those, how do we construct a kind of tapestry or network or meshwork of beneficial memes, and what might some of those be?
Yeah, I feel like if you, that's a million-dollar question. As soon as you figure it out, let me know. I have a few ideas. I mean, but just to touch on the sort of the individualization, I mean, there's growing, just a persistent trend is, you know, increasing isolation, you know, the erosion of community, which I think, you know, leads to increased depression and anxiety. The erosion of our social systems and connections, I do think it's a contributing factor to a lot of the, you know, increased like lone shooter, you know, lone wolf shooter or whatever shootings, mass shootings that we're seeing, you know, like I think a lot of other like social ills. And how you counteract that, I think, is in relationship with others, and in relationship with others around shared goals. And because it's only in relationship with others, I think that we can, you know, first recognize what our personal self-interests are, our passions, our ideational self-interests, our material self-interests, be able to advocate for those in relationship with others. And then also in that relationship with others, being able to recognize the self-interest of others. And to me, that's at the heart of democracy, that's at the heart of political action, and perhaps that's the source of our power, is being able to reconcile our own self-interest in the context of the larger whole. The more people we have who can do that, and in the process realize, and I mentioned this last week, that the difference between our self-interest and the interest of the greater good is much shorter than we've been led to believe. That in fact, what is better, what is good for the greater good is actually also good for ourselves. Of course, there are times when you need to advocate for your own self-interest, no doubt. But the more opportunities we can give to people to, you know, master that process, to develop an intimacy of themselves and how to navigate, you know, their self-interest with other people. I mean, that to me is movement building. And that's how, you know, that's where narratives are born, and that's where shared identities are born. And a lot of that is just based on my own experience living in co-op, like housing co-ops for the last 13 years.
TJ, did you want to say something?
Super important point. I mean, sometimes it's not even about creating necessarily a new meme. I mean, this country's supposed to be based on the idea that you bring people from literally from all over the world, and you create a political culture of freedom of expression for everybody. So it's almost like reinforcing what's already supposed to be the ideal. And just, I brought it up in the thread here. I mean, we're up against a lot of fear right now, and we're up against a polarization, a general polarization in our dysfunctional political system that we haven't seen. I'll probably go back to 1860, you know. And so it's a matter of what Stephen was saying about the more we're going to be very people in the middle, people who can question the dialogue, people who can step outside even of left and right for just a minute and say, well, what's the issue here? What's behind it? How are we going to find a solution to the issue instead of immediately jumping on either side of the fence and taking pot shots at each other? So, I mean, I see it more as there are good things, you know, in the American creed that we're just kind of moving away from, you know, and maybe like, you know, just kind of pushing in a positive way towards what we already know kind of deep inside should be happening here. Then
I wanted to respond that, you know, there's kind of this tension in having. So I think that to have better dialogues, to have to be able to include more different people's perspectives from your own into your own mind and into your own, you know, way of operating in the world, that takes a kind of spaciousness, a willingness to kind of set aside your own judgments, assessments, etc., and make space for what the other person is saying in your consciousness. But it's interesting because to have really high quality relationships where you're able to afford space, you know, in terms of your mental and emotional space for somebody else, you know, it actually requires being a fairly highly regulated person within. So there's this tension between kind of like a structured or like, you know, you know, learning certain methods of appropriate engagement and things like that, and containing your own impulses a little bit, right? To be, you know, present for somebody else. And so that actually takes a highly regulated person as opposed to an impulsive person, but yet the effect is one of integration and, you know, listening. And so I just find that kind of interesting that, you know, the, you know, high quality relationship actually has to do with spaciousness, but also structure, right? And being a regulated person. You want to respond?
Okay. John.
Just one note.
If you want to speak, just go ahead and unmute yourself when you're. When
oh,
you're
I ready. Can. Oh, I yes, thought I had can. To ask permission.
Oh no. You can self-regulate.
You guys are bringing up all kinds of stuff. But I just wanted to think about this, that our country came out of a Euclidean geometry. All the founding fathers studied Euclid. And our constitution, all of that came out of a very Newtonian, well, I don't know Newtonian, but definitely Euclidean worldview, where there's a subject here, an object over there, the subject is stable, the object changes. And we're the stable subject. I think we're moving into a more Einsteinian relativity, quantum mechanics kind of politics could be possible. I think we're going to have to let go. In order to find ourselves, we're going to have to let go of ourselves. And I think the topology that we've been talking about of the limnus gate and the Möbius strip, that twist in the Möbius strip, where the inside and the outside are blurred, and that higher development, I think, in the fourth dimension is when you get the Klein bottle, that hole in the Klein bottle, where everything gets deconstructed and reconstructed. So I think those metaphors that we've been playing with in our conversations, I think, are very new. And I think they embrace a much more complexity than our founding fathers, of course, many of whom were slave owners. We have to remember that institution collapsed. It was a worldwide institution. The slavery in the South collapsed in 4 years during the Civil War. And I think that's very interesting. So the kind of deranged politics that I think we're all suffering from, I hope it is going to, there'll be a rebirth, but I think we're going to have to reconcile ourselves to a great deal of turbulence before that happens. Thank you.
Yeah, I'd love to just go for a little bit. The turbulent, you know, like I can, the turbulence, literally the word you left me with is where I'd love to spring off from, John. Thank you. You know, I think I don't even know how to phrase this. If we're not criticizing civilization in itself, I think it's extremely problematic with all these types of conversations. So it's usually like this reformist civilization is the shared ideal, and then all that pollution and mountaintop removal and all that and war and poverty and all that stuff, we'll figure that out. So I just want to bring in more of a, you know, like, is the sustainability that I can only assume each of you have some sort of value for, is civilization propped up by binaries? Is it propped up by all these white supremacist mythos? Is it, you know, all of these economic mythos and America mythos and, I mean, nationalism? I mean, it's all imaginary. All of it's imaginary. It's a house of cards. You know, the trial that I'm on, I see the limits of the social construct that it is. And it has real world consequences to me, to everybody, to me personally. So I see the limitations of all these fucking social constructs and people, you know, like the transphobia that's going on right now. And it's just like, you know, John, when you spoke about imaginative and it's new and you know, like to me, this is like the postmodern, you know, dream potentially, you know, like to me, if I'm willing, if I hope gender and binary and hierarchy is a foundation of civilization, And if it's getting completely recontextualized and just completely torn apart, and it just loses all its social currency and civilization goes down with it, I honestly advocate for that. I think civilization itself is part of the, I mean, you can't have civilization without the amount of resource extraction that it takes to maintain civilization and overpopulation and all that stuff. I'm going to leave it there. Thank y'all.
I would like to ask TJ to comment, because I know, TJ, you are a student of civilizations and the cycles that they go through. And there may be some perspective you could offer that that looks at, like, what does it mean for a civilization to collapse? What does it mean for a civilization to have its foundations disintegrate? What does that look like from the meta perspective?
That's another one of those million-dollar questions that we figure out how to get rid of. I mean, we're kind of stuck because our global population right now, we can't go back to the wonderful egalitarian date. I mean, if there were wonderful, there's debate on that as well, of hunter-gatherers. Now, the values that they had and the kind of in-kin group supports that were there, which we kind of lost as societies got bigger and you have to include more and more people, and the wisdom of how to live on the planet without destroying everything around you, you know, on a systematic basis. So there's that. On the other hand, you know, you've got 7 billion going to 9 billion people to feed. That's going to need organization. So it's a phenomenal, I think I said it in one of the threads, it's a phenomenal modern double bind, because you can't get rid of it. Thomas Jefferson, right? You can't have a wolf by the ears and you can't let it go. You can't hold on to it, but you can't let it go. We're kind of in that situation. The civilization, do we need it? I would lean towards yes, because like I said, we have all these people to feed, but can we reorganize it? And then how would we do that? Alex, say it's like,
yeah,
it's a tall order. It's a tall order, that one.
Yeah. Yeah. But again, yeah, I mean, that's a million-dollar question, but I absolutely think that we can reorganize society within civilization, like as we know it, in a way that could feed upwards of 9 billion people.
Yeah, the resources are there.
Yeah, I absolutely do think the resources are there. I mean, like people in the United States, if the entire world were to consume as much as we do in the United States, we need like 5 or 6 Earths or something. So yeah, it is going to, you know, we are facing some turbulence, as you were, you know, saying, John. But you know, for me, like kind of coming from a permaculture ecological design perspective, you know, of course, permaculture doesn't have all the answers, but I believe there is a belief within permaculture that if we design our systems correctly in a way that takes care of people, the planet, and that shares the surplus, you know, reinvesting surplus back into the system, recycling nutrients, being smart about how we design, that we could in fact feed, you know, all the hungry mouths in the world in a way that is equitable. You know, again, that's my political imagination, and political imagination sort of where rubber meets the road is, you know, political will.
Right.
A political will in order to enact your imagination. And I think the only way that you do that is, I mean, you have to have a social movement that has a seat at the table when, for example, design decisions are made in urban environments. You have to be able to counteract elite power, concentrated private power that's actually been growing for the last 40 years. You know, transnational corporate elites that dictate economic production on a global scale that have a seat at, you know, political or at, you know, government with governments across the world like they never have. So I mean, the odds are stacked against us, but just the act of carrying forward an alternative narrative or an alternative meme in and of itself is a part of a good life for me. And any chance I get to share that with other people, I mean, that's it. You know, if we don't recapture the world, we at least have that.
At least be a voice for trying.
Yeah,
I agree. I agree.
Well, yeah, and we have the relationships that come from that. We have the food that we grow on our property because of that. We, you know, we just, yeah.
And like you said, TJ, what do we have to lose? I mean, really, by making this effort, I think it's much more interesting, whatever that. And I don't want to get caught up too much in optimism or pessimism. I can be both at the same time. I call myself a tragic optimist. You know, and you know, there may not be a God, but that doesn't stop me from praying. You know, we're full of these paradoxes, and I believe a new politics would emerge if we started to embrace our paradoxes rather than trying to get rid of them.
Beautiful. So we're almost at the end of our time, and I would like to ask Caroline to wrap up for us, maybe kind of lead us to the next curve, the next twist of the Mobius strip.
Yay, I like that metaphor.
And we have one more call coming up next week, and maybe you could give us some transition into that.
Well, our talk very much led into that terrain. So the next talk is going to be about collective realization. So at the intersection of life power and idea power or mythos, what is possible? What is possible in terms of how we want to live in meaningful ways? So we'll have some very cool guests, including Adam Brock, the permaculture author, and also leads a course called the social permaculture design course. So he investigates invisible structures. Oh, he also just published a book. This book right here, and it's actually a pattern language for social permaculture. So looking at some of the invisible structures in social and cultural systems and trying to name those and draw those out and describe those for what it might look like to construct, you know, social structures on a permaculture basis. And also we will have Magenta Saiba from Bloom Network. Bloom is kind of emerged out of the Evolver community, and it looks at spreading and disseminating and proliferating regenerative culture. So very much interested in media and story and, you know, really organizing people at the grassroots level who want to spread regenerative culture. So those are two guests that I know of. We might have more as well, but really we're taking what we kind of talked about and going even deeper on how could it look? What could we possibly achieve at that intersection between myth and, you know, living beings, consciousnesses? Anything to add, anybody?
Just to thank you and thank everyone who joined us and say you're all welcome back. And that next week, encourage folks to go to metapsychosis.com/Trumpocalypse and read your essays, Caroline. They're all published there now. Next week, we're publishing a piece by a fellow named Alexander Blum called The Case Against Liberation, Mystic Pessimism. So we're going to... We'll explore that perspective as well, perhaps. That's it, really. I mean, I think this was a wonderful conversation. Really appreciate you all being here. Thank you, TJ, Bridget. John, Stephen, Caroline, yeah. Alexei, and me.
Alexei, good luck, Alexei. Good luck.
Yeah.
God bless. Really. We'll send you energy.
So thank you all very much.
And real quick, I just want to thank Carolyn personally. Great set of essays. I did read, I think, the last bunch of them last week. Really well written and thought-provoking.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that so much. Thanks, everybody. Thanks for joining. Also, this was a great talk. I look forward to the next one.
Thank you, Caroline. Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thanks for having me.